This is Increment Vice. The podcast that explores Paul Thomas Anderson's inherent vice, one scene at a time, with your host, Travis Woods. The mystery of Shasta Faye Hepworth bookends inherent vice. Despite a few brief memories and cameos, she primarily anchors either end of the story, suffusing the long stretch of 2 hours and 30 minutes in between with the dusting of her star stuff. As if she is this universe's Big Bang and Big Crunch, the story cannot begin nor end without her. But even further, the story is her, a strange super cosmos of Shasta Faye. Sprinkled throughout this long tale is the history of Doc and Shasta, the two once young lovers who, in the words of their narrator, each gradually located a different karmic thermal. And at the exact moment of the film's halfway point, Shasta reappears as a postcarded memory in the film's and Paul Thomas Anderson's most heartrending moment, soaked in sweet melancholy like only PTA can orchestrate it. A memory that sends Doc hurtling towards the dark heart of Golden Fang. But how? Was the postcard a secret message from Shasta, coded in love talk to help him locate the Fang? Was it simply a note of lovesick regret and his flash to return to the scene simply a moment of coincidental luck? Is the appearance of the Fang's headquarters here, where Doc and Shasta once kissed, some brutal metaphor for time sweeping away their love? Or was the postcard simply a hallucination sent forth from some blood-kinked, cell-deprived fold of Doc's overtaxed cerebellum? What's real, and what is simple hope? What is a true memory, and what is the fictional story we tell ourselves to survive it? That's the question our host wrestles with today, while talking to someone who's no stranger to tales of mystery and love and time and space.
Concerning the making of a mystery film, today's guest once had this to say. Every single person who does any kind of mystery, it was like this with Brick, it was like this with Knives Out. You're on set living in a constant state of fear every time an actor comes up to you with a question. Because you're 95% sure they're about to ask something where you're going to blank and realize your entire story doesn't make sense. The complexity of who's where and when. There may be folks out there who would like to sit down with graph paper and work it all out, and that's part of the pleasure. But the reality is, most people are going to experience it as a narrative. The main way the story has to make sense is in an intuitive way, where you get the journey of the main person. Then you try to work out the other stuff, and hopefully it all lines up and makes sense. And joining me today, at the exact halfway point of Inherent Vice, with several sheets of graph paper to track the journey through the past of Doc Sportello, is a very special guest. The writer and director behind Brick, The Brothers Bloom, Looper, Star Wars The Last Jedi, Knives Out, and three, count them, one, two, three, of the all-time greatest Breaking Bad episodes ever, the absolutely annoyingly gifted Rian Johnson.
Are we at the halfway point?
We're at the halfway point of the movie.
Apex of Gravity's Rainbow right here.
The
engine's cutting off.
You can't reference Gravity's Rainbow. Nobody's read that.
Oh, come on.
Oh, see what I did?
Nerd.
I went and saw your movie.
I know you did.
I paid good money for that.
Did you read Gravity's Rainbow, though?
I did read Gravity's Rainbow. Yeah. I have read it. Yeah, I read it in college, as one does.
In college?
Yeah.
It was after college for me. Yeah.
Oh, well, look at me.
All right, sure. Sorry.
Making fun of me on my own show. Gotta say, as I was telling you earlier, as weird as it must be for you to be invited to a show that has absolutely nothing to do with any of your films.
Oh, so nice.
This feels weird.
Oh, it's so good.
Because I really want to, my instinct is to just pick your brain about all of your films rather than Inherent Vice.
Nope.
So I brought along this notebook.
I will walk out that door. I will drop you.
You don't want to talk about Knives Out?
Oh, God.
You're tired of Knives Out?
No.
Okay, screw it. I am going to ask one question. This is my show, and I'm going to be really selfish, and I just have to know.
Now hit me.
What level of influence Cowboy Bebop has had on your work? Because I always think of that scene in Brick where Brendan takes the straw and he ties it and he puts it back in as the most Spike Spiegelish
Very
thing I've ever seen.
Spike-esque.
Yeah, right?
That's the real folk blues right there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, we're like 5 minutes into this episode, and I'm going to start crying at the reference to the real folk blues.
I was so into that show, especially around the time when I was writing Brick. So you can feel kind of that rock and roll cowboy kind of like it, mostly in like the attitude of Brendan. And also Joe always reminded me of Spike. Joe always, especially when we were doing Brick, he had that kind of like lanky sort of.
He's got the walk and the shape.
He's got the walk, the way he hunches over a little bit and just kind of like the attitude of it. And so, you know, in the beginning of Looper also when he's like partying in the city, there's like some element of Spike to that too. So no, it's just tied to coolness in my head, you know.
It is cool. It's the coolest. And I won't lie, speaking of Looper, when he's laying in bed,
does the little gun click,
bang.
See a space cowboy. Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to do the Cowboy Bebop episode after this.
All right, incremental Bebop.
Yes.
I'm calling the Pierre LeFou. What is it? The Pierre LeFou?
Pierre LeFou.
Yeah, I'm calling that episode.
Scariest episode,
man.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
is that your
terrifying
episode?
Terrifying. I tell you, I call it right now. I call dibs.
I am a real folk blues man.
All right.
You can have that episode.
Okay,
fine.
All right.
Okay. Sheer selfishness of my digression aside, my Cowboy Bebop Brick digression aside, it's not the worst place for us to start. Mm. Cowboy Bebop is essentially a kaleidoscope of mostly American genre filmmaking and a tribute to that. And I wanted to actually begin this episode by talking to you about that very broad topic of genre. Now, despite the fact that you've made a Hammett-inspired noir, a con man caper picture, a time travel film, a space opera, and a murder mystery whodunit, I don't really think of you as a genre filmmaker, despite the fact that I feel like all of your films are very genre heavy. More, and this might be splitting hairs, but it seems to me that for you, genre acts like an organizing principle for your ideas and your characters by utilizing the rules and requisites of a particular genre and then going to their own place, which is why I thought you'd be great for talking about Inherent Vice.
That's interesting.
Does the same thing.
Yeah, it gives you kind of genre, gives you like a box to play in, I guess.
Now, when you say interesting, are you doing that director writer thing where someone tells you something that's way off the mark about how you view your own work and you're like, yeah, that's cool.
Oh, that's
interesting. I'm glad you think of that's cool that you see it that
you
way.
You know all the tricks,
sure,
don't you?
Sure.
You know every single trick in the book. No, it is actually. It's interesting because I mean, and the way it you know, yeah, I mean, I've you know, because we just put out Knives Out and I just did like a long tour of Q&As and stuff. And so it's funny, like over the course of, and I don't want to cheapen anyone's experience who's enjoyed a Q&A I've done, but over the course of doing them, you do tend to cultivate a set of answers because there's only so many questions you can be asked about any given thing. So my typical answer to like when someone asks about genre is just, yeah, it gives you a defined box to play in. I like it because of that. But then because of that, because it creates a subliminal conversation between you and the audience, it allows you to kind of take chances and to reach further and to go places and to bake in some thematic things that if they were just kind of naked on their own might not stand the light of day, I guess. But what I was responding to when I was saying interesting is thinking about this genre of the private detective genre and thinking of it in relation both to Pynchon and to PTA. And in a weird way, I mean, because Cowboy Bebop, you brought up, it's Cowboy Bebop, it is absolutely this sort of pastiche of American genres, but it's all filtered through a foreign sensibility of a very Japanese sensibility. Similar to like Sergio Leone, you know.
Exactly.
With the Westerns.
Exactly, yeah.
And sometimes that's the most fascinating thing, is to have a foreign perspective on something that is very American, you know, very distinctly American. It can open up sort of, I don't know. And in some ways, I feel like that's what the, in very different ways, the book of Inherent Vice and the film, they're both kind of takes on this very specific genre by guys who are completely foreign to that. Yeah, it's, yeah. I don't know. It's like an alien interpreting.
Well, I mean, you read Inherent Vice, the book especially, and it is, it's like a bunch of aliens.
Yeah.
Watched all the different iterations of a Marlowe movie.
Yeah.
We're like, well, I guess that's how they talk on Earth. Like, so there's got to be a gal in the doorway, and she's got to come with a problem.
But it's even, I mean, in a way, the movie is almost more fascinating to me in that regard, because the book, I mean, Pynchon, you know, he rolls with the PI conventions even a little bit more than the movie does. What I find so fascinating about the movie is, you know, the Marlowe or the Sam Spade, you know, the Hammett or the Chandler, you know, that kind of tradition of the private detective thing. It's so based on words and information and exposition. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I can't think of a movie that depends on that that detests exposition more than Inherent Vice does. It absolutely hates information. And you can see in the actors, the characters, the movie itself, it tosses words away. It almost feels like you can feel almost a sense of disgust it has that it has to impart information to the audience through words in a way, because it's so rooted in poetry. And it's, mm-hmm. that's not saying it to its detriment. I think that actually makes it, that's part of what I think, I don't know, makes PTA's movies, he's my favorite filmmaker working today, and I think that's part of what makes his movies so special is the is that they're so rooted in, I don't know, poetry that kind of transcends words, I think, you know.
Yeah, and I think you're so right, and I agree, that the book is so much more rooted, I think, in the mythos and the archetypes, but it's Pynchon also having fun with those. Like, I think he's being Pynchon.
It plays ball, though.
Yeah.
You know? It plays ball.
But what it's interesting to me is how clearly, you know, I went into the film the first time I saw it. I'd read the book. So I kind of had a grasp of the plot.
Yeah.
However wacky. Like,
yeah.
I more or less knew A, B, C, and D.
Yeah.
What I found so interesting about the film and why I love the film, I enjoy the book.
Mm-hmm.
Love the film. Well, yeah. It's funny that I'm telling you that I love the film as we're sitting here having a podcast. Yeah,
you fucking better. It'd be weird if you didn't.
I think it's weird how much I do. You know, what I love about the film is, as you said, like, so much of the detective stuff.
Yeah.
The movie's like, no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
That's to get us here. To get us in the room talking.
There's a scene where Doc is like, we're in the movie, where Joaquin as Doc is like at the cafe reading a paper, and I forget what it is, a summary of like...
It's the background of Mickey Wolfman.
And at some point, he's reading vital information to the plot. And at some point, you can see he literally tosses away and just goes, nya, 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 nya.
He's so
I
pissy.
Don't want to say this shit. And that I think, to me, sums up what you're talking about.
When I watch I'm so glad you mentioned that, because every time I watch that scene, I wonder if that is one of those moments where that wasn't scripted, and Joaquin was just like, no.
Yeah, I'm not.
And PTA saw it, like, keep it, cut it, print. That's the take.
I'm reading this shit.
Because who gives a shit?
Absolutely.
But what two things I love about this movie is, if you do want to be like Doc, and I think I'm kind of doing this a little, if you want to sit at the whiteboard and write out all the connections, and Shasta the Koi, and Puck Beaverton, it all does hang together. Mm-hmm. The movie makes total sense if you do want to. But what I enjoyed about the book was that it used the framework of the detective genre to investigate essentially the murder scene of an entire generation.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Pynchon's focus.
Right.
The a man writing in 2009, looking back at what happened angrily and lamenting it and using the metaphor of a breakup.
Right.
And the one you're not going to be able to get back, no matter how hard you try.
Right.
And maybe don't know quite as well as you thought you did.
Yeah.
What I love, though, about the film, and I've said this so many times on this show, is how PTA inverts that and how he takes the metaphor, the subtext, and makes that text. To me, when I watch this movie, it's not about lamenting the 1960s and lamenting the dream. It's just, as PTA said, it's just about how much you can miss someone.
Yeah.
Like how badly you, how much you just can't let them go to your own detriment.
Well, and it's funny how, I mean, specifically the scene, not to jump the gun, but the scene we're going to talk about, the difference between how it is on the page versus how he approaches it in the movie is maybe the crystallized version of exactly what you just said. You know, and it exemplifies it.
Before we hit the scene, let's talk about that because it is, it's kind of chilly. In the book, right?
Like, do you it's find freezing, it to be a little... and it's you're talking about that scene specifically.
This scene specifically. So the scene in the book,
it's cold and it's nearly apocalyptic. You know, he goes into it. He acknowledges kind of the romance of like the situation of it, but then he goes into the, you know, he describes the storm and this like raging storm that's coming over LA in these almost apocalyptic terms. And he talks about looking at this hole in the ground that is going to become the Golden Fang building. And it's like staring into like the depths of hell. It's like this looming sense of doom is what eventually takes over and dominates.
It's malignant.
The scene, very much so, yeah.
I've read the book far too many times, just as I've seen the film far too many times. And I reread that scene last night, and perhaps because I was focusing on this scene in specific, it struck me how terrifying and creepy it is. Like you said, there's this like tar black cataract that just falls over LA out of nowhere.
Yeah.
There's nothing summer rain sweetness about it the way there is in the film. Like you see that in the movie, you want to like take your shirt off and run in the streets. It's that perfect kind of LA rain, not the brutal cold LA rain we're having this weekend.
Sure.
But that great
brutal. How long have you lived here?
It rained from 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. straight.
It dipped
yesterday.
Into the low 60s.
That's how you know I have lived here for a long time because that was brutal for me.
I'm saying, you've been here too long.
I thought I was living in an igloo yesterday. But in the film, it's that kind of great LA summer rain where it doesn't even get the sun doesn't even go away completely.
Yeah.
But in the book, it's like I said, it's tar black. And Doc and Shasta don't even get out of the car. They just kind of sit there and they make out.
Yeah.
And there's this strange tense change at the very end of the scene where he's like, you know, they're making out despite the fact that, you know, Shasta was halfway out the door and they both knew how this ended.
Right.
It's like his memory is almost intruding on the scene and putting that on them.
The bigger picture of the storm looming over late 1960s LA, and what you're talking about of the bigger thing of the darkness that's coming in terms of, you know, this generation kind of being eaten up and kind of destroyed, you know, that is what dominates the scene and to see the movie, to see, you know, Paul take that and it gets to the heart, that difference in terms of how he treats a scene gets to the heart of it. You can see exactly where the movie's heart is, you know? You can see where the movie puts its chips down. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and again, I think it goes back to that thing where the book is so much a lamenting of that place and that time. And as PTA said, no, this is about love.
Yeah.
This is a love story. And and I think that, I don't think that there is another scene in the film, as you've said, that so underlines the difference that these two men approach to telling this story and what interests them.
Very much.
I don't think the end of the decade, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is a great film, which I love, but I don't think that's what Paul's interested in here. It's not about lamenting this time. It's just these two people that can't make it work.
I'd go so far as to say the book, you've read the book a lot more than I have. Tell me if you disagree that the book actually, the main focus of it is not on the Shasta Doc relationship. It's much more of a kaleidoscope. It's much more just one element.
That's what gets Doc into the mess.
Yeah. And it's much more about like it almost has, if not equal focus, but closer to equal focus to, you know, all these other elements that are spinning around him.
The Coy Harlingen case.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And Wolfman. And there's so many more digressions about the LA land use, which is the best part of any LA noir. You got to throw in the land use and abuse if you're going to do an LA noir.
Exactly,
you have to.
Yeah.
If Brick had been set in Los Angeles, you know that would have been there. Penn would have been like making these shady real estate deals instead of dealing heroin. Spoilers, I guess, if someone's missed Brick. It's just – on top of you say that this film, or excuse me, this scene is shows how much, you know, heart there can be had here. To me, this scene is the heart of the movie.
Yeah, very much.
You know,
so.
When you go in and you see a PTA movie the first time,
yeah,
I don't know about you, but every single time I've walked out of the theater, there's the one scene that's buzzing in my head like a chorus that I can't lose. First time I walked out of There Will Be Blood, it's the oil rig. Boogie Nights. Well, I didn't see that in a theater. I was a kid. But.
Oh, my God. You're a child.
Ah. Look at this white and this beard, Ryan. Look at this.
Look at all this gray I got. I am the Wolfman.
the Night Ranger sequence in Boogie Nights.
Sure.
Throw a dart, you'll find one. You know, with Inherent Vice, though, it's a much more relaxed, more minor key film. There still is that one set piece when you walk out. And if unless your mind is still ringing with Josh Brolin eating pancakes or pot, it's this scene. This is the capital M marquee sequence that I think says, this is everything the film is about. This is everything it is. And it's not just because it has that atomic core of, you know, bruised romance at the center. There's so much else happening here, whether it's the intrusion of Sœur de Liège into this memory. Is she real? Is she not?
Right.
You have the beginnings of the Fang.
Yeah.
And the realization that the bad thing that we're dealing with now was actually the firmaments and the foundation were already being put in place long before everything was great.
Yeah.
And that inability to even look back and remember without things being tainted. Yeah. To be able to look back and go, oh no, she was already halfway out the door,
right. Yeah. Boy, yeah.
I kind of use a hug right now. I'm getting kind
of. Oh, shit. I'd hug you, but coronavirus. Sorry, buddy.
Speaking of really scary rainstorms foretelling doom.
Hug physician, hug thyself.
This is podcaster, squeeze thyself. We are recording this on a very strange weekend in March where it's raining a lot in LA.
Yeah.
And hopefully is not spelling some sort of some sort of doom for us.
I can't imagine it is.
Boy, we are really Neroing our violins right
let's
into
fiddle,
the...
Let's fiddle away.
Our fiddles, excuse me.
Let's fiddle away,
oh, he's got to correct me on my own show. Did you catch that?
Yeah, man. No, it's weird. So when you walked out of the movie for the first time, did you love it?
Yes.
Yeah. It got you immediately.
In addition to being just kind of generally insane, obviously, because here, look at what we're doing right now. Look how I've taken your Saturday. I am a sucker for the detective movie.
Yeah.
Specifically that sub genre of the loser detective who just has got to do one good thing.
Yeah.
One thing.
Yeah.
And the more minor the thing, almost the more special it is.
Mm.
Because what I love about, I love Hammett.
Yeah.
I love Hammett.
Yeah.
And I love Red Harvest. And I love the detective that goes in. He's like, no, I'm going to walk in cowboy style.
Yeah.
I'm going to fuck everything up.
Yeah.
And I'm going to walk out with my rules and my idea of justice having been applied.
Right.
And I'm out. I'm going to bust it all up and I'm going to move to the next place.
Yeah.
I'm an even bigger sucker, though, for that detective who's like, I'm only going to be able to do this one minor thing.
Right.
That's it. But that's, there's something almost more redemptive about the detective or the hero who's like, I'm going to lay everything on the line for this, such a minor thing in the scheme of things. Like, I'm not going to stop the Fang.
Mm-hmm.
Nixon's going to be president.
Mm-hmm.
America's going to go the way America's going to go.
Yeah.
But I'm going to make sure that this little girl and her dad are back together.
Right.
I can do that.
Right.
And the fact that he's willing, he's not risking his life to save the country.
Right.
He's not really, to save a town or anything.
It's
just so this one little girl gets to wait a little bit longer before she gets hit with the little kid blues. So, I loved the book, but none of that emotion was in it. So when I walked out as a PTA fan, I had the most beatific, goofball, Nicholson's Joker virus smile from Batman on my face walking out of the theater.
Yeah.
I was smiling like that after the first 8 minutes because, I mean, I've said it before. When you have a cool-ass neon font as your title card.
You got Can.
You got Joaquin Phoenix, probably his generation's most intense performer.
Yeah.
doing detective shit. Like, yeah. I'm done. I'm good. Like, he could have cut the movie right there. Could have been a short movie, and I would have been. I'm still doing a podcast.
Watch your toes. Yeah.
No one mentions that. Watch your toes. Breaks my heart every time.
Watch your toes.
And then it's really quiet. Yeah. But of course, I've noticed right after that, she to herself, she whispers, "I'm going."
Really?
Yeah. Like she's forcing her. Like she wants to stay.
Wow.
When you watch a movie 180 times, right, you begin to notice certain little subtleties. And one of my favorites is when Shasta Faye is driving away in her car. She's like, "Watch your toes." Very sweet.
Yeah.
And then she takes a breath, like she's steeling herself, and she says, "I'm going." And just drives off into the night.
Wow.
Right. I was sold. So yes, that is my very long way of saying, yes, Ryan,
yes,
I enjoyed the film when I walked out. Did you love it? Because I know that it's not a film that everyone loves the first time through.
No, the first time. And I said how I feel about his movies, you know. And the thing that you're describing, I had when I walked out of, you know, There Will Be Blood and The Master and definitely Phantom Thread. And like, I mean, I have that when I walk out of his films. This one was different. I had to find my way into loving this movie, and I did.
It's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. And it's the other reason I was excited to talk about this scene, because Neil Young had a lot to do with how I found my way into loving this movie. But I feel like, yeah, I don't know. I feel like when I first saw it, there was a push and pull for me between the play. Maybe it's just because I was so like hung up on like this idea of what a Hammett thing is, but between like the plot and the poetry. And when I first saw it, I felt like those two things were at odds with each other in me when I was watching the movie. And I'll be honest, like even today, like this might sound horrifying, but like my perfect way of watching it is to watch chunks of it at a time, as opposed to sitting and absorbing the entire thing.
There are people who are watching it that way now, along with the show, just doing a scene at a time.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, honestly, it's like, essentially what started pulling me in was I started getting into like, you know, early 70s Neil Young. Like I started getting, which is a little anachronistic. What year is the movie take?
The year is 1970.
70,
all of
okay.
the Neil Young cuts are totally out of time.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
They're all like
yeah.
2 or 3 years early
yeah.
in this film.
Yeah. So I started getting into that era of Neil Young, and it was around when I was like making Last Jedi. I just started listening to it all the time, and because I was in London making it, I had that kind of nostalgia you get for LA that you only get when you're away from LA. And the movie, I found myself coming back to the movie because it for me, I realized. And it all clicked at once, just like the way that, you know, Joaquin dresses, just like Neil Young in the movie and all that stuff. This is what the movie does in such a powerful way for me is creates an LA of the mind that never existed.
Really,
but for
there.
Those of us who were a little too young to experience that kind of, you know, that kind of late 60s, early 70s kind of disintegration of the, you know, of the canyon scene, sort of, you know, of the canyon music scene. The way that those of us listen to our parents listening to those tunes and conjured up a vision of what life was like in LA at that moment. And there's something about the film that, in the same way that, you know, with the deep romance that like The Master or There Will Be Blood or Phantom Thread does, this film conjures that. And the poetry of that is what suddenly it was like the gravitational force of a black hole just pulled me right into it, you know.
You know, it's strangely, I still wrestle with what is it about the movie that makes it this way. But you remember when you would go to like a bookstore in the mall in the 90s and there would be those posters that you have to like cross your eyes, and if you cross your eyes just
Magic
right,
eye.
Yeah,
yeah,
you'd see the sailboat,
yeah.
Until you saw the sailboat, you could never see the sailboat.
Right.
But once you saw it, it's always a sailboat. It's all you yell at your friends. I don't know what you're not seeing. It's right here.
Yeah.
You can't not see it. That's what this film seems to be about. Seems to be like for people like you, for whom it is more of a grower.
Yeah,
is that you spend the longest time going, I don't see it. It's just shapes. It's just pink and blue and purple blobs and shapes.
Right.
And then there's that day, and I think, as you said, for you, it's like the Neil Young part of it in that, that God, I'm missing California, and you start kind of looking back and, oh, I see what, it's a postcard.
Mm-hmm.
It's a postcard for what it should have been, what it could have been, what I want it to have been. And then all of a sudden, the movie's just there for you.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I see it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of postcards, before we get into this scene proper, which is postcard heavy, I had one more general advice question for you. This is, as we've said, it's a very unique adaptation. It's a very unique way of telling the novel and a very different way of telling the story than the novel goes about it. And you are, you've never done a straight like adaptation. You have, I think, really looked at Hammett, for instance, with Brick. There's a whole history of kind of road and con man movies that I think flowed into Brothers Bloom. But you take something like Star Wars The Last Jedi, you are, you're kind of adapting the characters to your story and your vision for them. And, oh, really quick, I just should take a quick moment just because people might not know this. And you're probably going to be too polite to say anything. You'll probably go, oh, sure.
I doubt that.
You'll do the director. Interesting. I'm just going to say it in case there's any confusion. Star Wars The Last Jedi is the best Star Wars film.
Oh, yes.
It's the this pop cultural juggernaut that defines Western pop. It's the best one.
Interesting. It's very kind of you.
It just needed to be said. But speaking of which, you are someone who had to deal with the, I think, probably very intense, terrifying pressure of here's this universe and here's this world and here's this way of telling the story. And I'm going to continue it in a way that honors the telling of the other parts of the story. But I have to do it the way that it makes sense to me.
Right.
And I have to do it in a way that makes sense to the way I make films and the way these characters make sense to me.
Right.
And I'm curious then how you look at PTA's way of taking this very strange story and making it what he did. Did you read the book before having seen the film and then to the film going, what the hell was this?
I read the book when it came out, but that was a little bit right before the movie came, I think. Or how much time was
it? The book was like 09, and then the movie was 2014.
Yeah, so I had read the book a while ago. But when I saw it, it's not like I revisited the book first. And I'm a very big Pynchon fan, and the book, I had the same reaction to the book as you. I enjoyed it, but it didn't really hit me between the eyes or something. And I felt, and it's weird, like the connections between it and Vineland, which did floor me when I read it.
Which is it's almost like two halves of the same story, two sides of the same coin.
Really does,
One's more of like a family novel and much, much larger and broader in scope.
Yeah.
And then you have the straight up, no, we're just going to make a subgenre, or I'm going to write a subgenre book, not we.
I think maybe because Vineland was such a thing for me, I think maybe that's why when I read Inherent Vice, it kind of did get kind of filed as like a sub, a sub thing, which is totally unfair. And and actually because I had read it back then, I don't know if you've heard the audiobook of it.
No, huh?
It's really well read. It's really good. I forget the actor's name who did it, but it's really good. So I actually listened to that in preparation for this. Like, I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks lately.
That's
so
incredible.
Yeah, it was really cool.
And I feel really guilty. I mean, I'm glad you enjoyed it, but I feel guilty that you put that little level of time.
You should feel guilty, yeah.
I mean, I barely woke up before it was time to do this. But yeah, just as someone who's dealt with the pressure of adapting a story.
Well,
your pressure might have been a little different. I don't know that there was quite the fandom for Thomas Pynchon's Inherent Vice novel that there was for Star Wars.
Very specific, small, but more passionate Pynchon fan base, probably. But also, I mean, I think part of talking before about like finding my way into loving the movie, part of that was letting go of its connection to Pynchon in a weird way for me. It wasn't, part of it was saying, was taking it as, okay, the movie. And I still, like, even just having read, after I finished in my like reread. You ever feel guilty saying read after you listen to the audiobook or something?
I feel like I'm a liar.
I feel like I'm a liar.
I feel like a liar and a cheat when I say that I've You know, I recently was listening to the Jeremy Irons reading of Lolita, which is amazing.
I hear it's great.
It is, because he gives an actual performance and not, you know, it's not the not great Adrian Lin film. But he actually gives a performance and it's breathtaking. But then, you know, not if there was like a Letterboxd, I don't use like Letterboxd books, but like, you know, I'm not on Goodreads, but I feel really guilty if someone goes, what's the last thing you read? Oh, Lolita. Yeah.
Well, after I re-listened to Inherent Vice, I sat down and watched the movie, and that was my least favorite viewing of the movie I've had in a while.
Oh.
Because I was constantly comparing it to the book. And not that the movie suffered by comparison to the book. It didn't, but you've had this experience of the words that Pynchon conjures for you. You've directed versions of that in your head. And then it's just, there's more math going on in your head when you're watching it then, because you're translating each of the scenes into, oh, it's interesting. Even if you like it, it's like, oh, it's interesting. He chose to do this. Oh, it's interesting. He's approaching it like this. Oh, that's interesting. It's missing this, or it's adding this.
Or he kept that line of all the lines. That's the line you keep.
And so the reason I've never adapted or been interested in adapting is because if I love a book, the furthest thing from my mind is turning it into a movie. It's like loving a pair of shoes and saying, oh, I'm going to knit a great sweater out of these shoes. They're so completely different. And especially somebody like Pynchon, who is so, he's so specific in the way that he uses words and uses language. It's a world of words, you know what I mean? It doesn't translate to, I think maybe a graphic novel could come closer to, or a comic book could come closer to translating Pynchon than a movie. But especially, that's why it's so interesting to me, especially a filmmaker like PTA, who is so visual and so poetic in terms of his approach. It's the schism between what they do, what Pynchon does, and what
so
PTA is so vast, and that's why it makes the movie. But that's in a way perfect, because that means the movie just has to completely let go and has to be its own thing. It doesn't have any other choice, you know.
And it's fascinating that you say you can imagine a great comic book version of the novel, like a more novel accurate
just
version of the story.
Just in general, in terms of Pynchon.
Well, what's interesting about that is PTA intentionally, one of the reasons that the shots themselves, like, they almost look like they're composed for like a 4x3 TV or something, because everything is so compressed.
Yeah.
And it's always just these two shots or over the shoulder shots. So there's none of these like very like long, wild ass camera takes or huge vistas. Yeah. And apparently it's because he wanted the film to look like a comic book where all the information is just packed into the background, and everything is so densely compressed, and you have just focus at the center panel of what you're looking at.
That's interesting.
Which is just some random nerd errata for you to carry on with you for the rest of your day.
I like it.
All right. Ryan and I are going to take a break. We're going to watch this scene, and then we're going to be right back to talk about it.
You don't remember the Ouija board, do you, Doc? It had been one of those prolonged times of no dope.
You think he knows where we can score?
Ask. Just do it by yourself like that. Nobody had any. Everybody was desperate and suffering lapses of judgment.
4, 2, 9, 3.
It's a phone number.
1, 2, 5, 1.
Sorry, Jen.
Howdy, dopers. We've got whatever you need. And remember, the sooner you get over here, the more there'll be left for you. So come on down to 4723 Sunset Boulevard.
Okay, I'm sorry. Who is it that talked to? She hung up.
She's screaming at you. Stay away. I'm a police trap. There's a problem with Ouija boards.
When the winter rains come pouring down on that
sure did its work. They didn't score any dope that day, but somehow suddenly it didn't matter. It was weird that in the limited space of a postcard, Shasta should have chosen to remember that one day in the rain. It had stuck with Doc, too, even though it was late in their time together when she was already halfway out the door.
Now I'm going.
This is perfect.
Journey through the past.
This is the second time Ryan's made me cry today.
Yeah.
And how appropriate is it that because we are recording this when the world is ending, that we got bumped from my normal studio and we are now recording this in the same building right next to the very same room, which we just toured, where Neil Young recorded his very first album in 1969.
It's crazy.
It's wild, no?
It's crazy.
It's great.
What year was Journey Through the Past? The movie was like 74 or something,
The
right?
movie was 74. Yeah. The song, he used to introduce it live in the early 70s as "This is a Song Without a Home."
Song Without a Home. Well, yeah, that's the interesting thing is like—
Because he didn't have it on a proper record. It just bounced around. I think it came out. I think he wrote it the first appearance on a live record, I think, is 73, 74.
Yeah, okay. Is that Time Fades Away?
Time Fades Away, the live record.
Which is a vastly superior performance and recording of it than the studio track, I think. That's the one thing I'm a little bummed about with this, is that they used the studio track. I understand why they did, because I think he was influenced by that movie, and I think pulling from it makes a lot of sense. But I find the live version on Time Fades Away so heartbreaking and intimate and beautiful.
There's a fragility to it all.
Yeah.
I'm very sweet on the version that's in the film.
Yeah.
But I get there's something that feels like it's gonna break.
Yeah.
If you turn it up a little too loud.
Yeah.
If you don't listen to it on just the right set of speakers, it's gonna break.
Well, it's also, I mean, sometimes you put a track under a movie and you realize it needs maybe to back up the scene, it needed a little bit more backbone beneath
it. Or you just don't want the crowd noise in the
background. Yeah, that's true.
But I also feel like the live version is almost too sad.
Yeah, maybe.
Whereas I feel like in this scene there's definitely the melancholy that surprised, I think, everyone the first time they saw this film. I don't think anyone expected this movie to be as goddamn sad.
Well,
as it was.
I remember, like, because you always get like false rumors before a PTA movie comes out. Like, I remember,
it's Big Lebowski, it's His Long Goodbye.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's like Airplane.
He's
oh, it's goofiness, man.
This is a Zucker Brothers movie, man.
That's just the same way somebody told me, like, before I watched Phantom Thread, like, they're like, oh, I remember someone was writing online, this is like it's 9 and a half weeks. This is like a and I watch it, and I kept waiting for when's the kinky shit coming. I was bracing myself.
I'm just waiting for the moment that Mickey Rourke kicks the door down with some ice cubes and a knife or something like that. Well, I mean, it's a thirsty movie, but it's a very chilly thirst in that film.
Yeah,
it's a very unspoken thirst, let's say. But wow, his 9 and a half weeks.
I don't know what somebody wrote it online, but I had a buddy who was working on it, and I like said that to him, and he didn't say anything. He just like cocked an eyebrow at me.
Although I love the idea. I can imagine someone. I would love to see Paul's reaction.
I know, he would love it, Brian.
Oh, well, yeah, man, I guess. Smacking the gum. Yeah, man, we try to make it sexy, make a good movie.
That's a pretty good.
It's not a bad one. I'll take it, sure.
That's a damn good impression. Holy shit, wow.
I've watched way too many PTA interviews.
Are you going to have him on, by the way? Are you going to have him around for,
Working on it,
all right.
We're working on it.
Yeah.
I'm not supposed to say anything on here.
All right.
Well, I guess I just did. So this scene, let's start with Joanna Newsom.
Yeah.
Why not?
That was the other reason I wanted to talk about the scene, was just to have a chance to talk about Joanna Newsom a little bit.
Which, we'll take a brief diversion. It's an Inherent Vice podcast. So there's going to be lots of side streets we're going to go down.
Yeah.
Just want to say, this is the most demanded scene.
Yeah.
That second. The most in-demand scene.
Pancakes?
Everyone wanted. No.
Eating the pot?
Bananas.
Bananas. Oh, no shit.
The wantonly filleting of a banana
Do you tie that into the scene in the police station before it, or just the wantingly eating the band in the
just,
car?
It was just that sure. hard
All
minute.
Right. All right.
And we had, and you know, we had chocolate covered frozen bananas during the episode.
Oh, it was nice. Who did it?
Mariah Gates, TCM Filmstruck.
Yeah, sure. Right,
yeah.
Right.
yeah. And it, they were terrible. It's a horrible, horrible snack. Horrible snack. I regretted
delicious.
It.
And it was so good.
Oh, no.
No, I love it. I have great memories
and I
of hate, chocolate.
And I hated we did the bit because I was stuck doing it the whole episode and it was just terrible.
What's the backstory in the book that he has like a whole backlog of frozen bananas because he was going to dry them and grind the banana peels to make fake dope, right?
Yep.
And it's like,
and then
but it's also got the connection to Gravity's Rainbow, to the opening scene where I don't know if you remember the banana feast that starts.
There is, you're right.
Gravity's Rainbow.
What's his name?
Is it Roger Mexico?
Yep.
The paragraphs and paragraphs describing the banana brunch.
So this
anyway.
Is the kind of hard-hitting content you get when you tune into Increment Files. Tune in, like my radio show. But no, I was going to say that that was a wild digression. This is the second most.
Right.
Everyone's like, can I get the
privileged.
Sad running in the rain scene?
Feel
can
privileged.
I have that scene?
But
what was funny to me is when we were first talking about what scene you were going to do, you didn't say, oh, I need the scene where they're in love in the rain.
Yeah.
I got to have, you know, with Danielia. You were like, I need the Joanna Newsom scene with the Ouija board.
Yeah.
I need Joanna Newsom. I've been thinking about her a lot.
And
what brought you?
I'm coughing because I swallowed water wrong, by the way. I don't want everyone to panic and flee.
I don't know if no one can see us right now, but like all these guys in hazmat suits just ran
everyone
in.
Everyone just
these red lights came
the
on.
Floor.
And we're going to be like getting sprayed with like those 1950s prison movie delousing hoses when we get out of here. Thanks, Ryan. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Fun Saturday we're going to have today. But no, you were like, I really want to talk about Joanna.
Yeah. Yeah, who I don't want to. Yeah, it's not like I know her, but I just am such a big fan of her music. I mean, so The Milk Eyed Mender was like I think it's her first album, and that's when I got into
the first. The next one is I never know how to pronounce it. Is it
Yeezy?
I know that's the one I'm supposed to love the most.
Oh, it's great! It's fantastic.
I love it.
Sure, yeah,
but I know it's the one I'm supposed to love the most, and I'm a Divers guy.
Oh, Divers is beautiful, but Yeez, why is
Yeez
has those beautiful. Oh, it's so dense, that album. It's got those Van Dyke. Parks. It's got his arrangements,
gorgeous.
Which is amazing.
I think one of the reasons why, I really enjoy it, but the reason why I don't listen to it more is that's one of those records I have to stop.
You can't just casually listen to it.
I have to look at the turntable and do nothing else but just ingest.
And you're going to need a nap after you listen to it.
So
it's really, so I've probably done more writing to Joanna Newsom's music than maybe any other
artist. How can you concentrate on your
artist? I don't know, man. Like something about, you know, I can write really well in crowded public spaces because sort of it gives me something, the complexity of it gives me something to, but I find her really, the lyrics and the combination of everything, you know, there's something that's just really inspiring about her music for me. And I just, I think she's incredible. And she married to Andy Samberg?
She is.
Who is also a genius, who's also fucking incredible. So that's like an incredible power couple right there.
They're great.
But her music, oh my God. Yeah, and it's funny, like I have one on me, like has a couple tracks on it also that I've been like listening to a lot recently. And it's just, it feels like her music just has it.
It's a world.
It's a whole world, and it's this very deep well that I can keep coming back to. It's also incredibly polarizing music. Like I find that I play it for friends, and they're either going to love it or they're going to not even.
Well, she's
be
like
able to
she's like Inherent Vice. It's you're either going
to
find your way, or it's like no.
It makes sense.
No, sir. No, ma'am.
But I've been in from the beginning, man, and so. Just the fact that she plays kind of this otherworldly presence in the movie. And I think I haven't seen her act in any other stuff. I think she's really good in it. And
This is why like PTA is PTA and the rest of humanity is the rest of humanity. he's the guy's like, Let's get Joanna Newsom and make her a narrator that doesn't exist in the book. Just, I want to hear whole chunks of Pinchonese.
Yeah.
That'd be a good way. Just let's hear her, let's hear her voice translate. I mean,
you're talking about just like adaptation wise, it's a really smart device because there is just a lot of, narration stuff that is stuff you need to hear that wouldn't make sense to jam into dialogue. So he needed to figure out some way to kind of have a narrator. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that character exists in the book. It's just she doesn't narrate.
She's just a hippie gal. Yeah. Hangs out with Doc. Yeah. She used to be a secretary.
Yeah.
But what I love, it's also a tribute to Pynchon's work and that he said, PTA said in interviews, he's like, how do I cut out all of that great, those linguistic
fantastic
and curly cues that he creates?
Yeah.
Like, how do you make a Pynchon book but then leave out the Pynchon?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you can have
By the way, have you figured out whether Pynchon pops up in the movie anywhere?
Well, I have thoughts.
I know,
we're going to do digression number 37
Let's do it.
Right now.
All right.
Since we're waiting for the delousing crew anyway, now that Ryan coughed, we're in a lot of trouble now.
Yeah.
There's a guy who's clearly dressed up to look like Pynchon of this era.
And what's he?
In the Topanga Canyon house sequence, the house party.
That makes a lot of sense. It's a dense scene.
And it's very obvious that we're having a wink here.
Yeah.
In that scene, you see him walking around in the periphery when Doc is walking around and looking at everybody, and he's noticing the bikers with the swastikas and everything. But in the subsequent beat, when Owen Wilson and Joaquin are sitting at the table and they're talking
about
the little
kid blues,
there's a guy who literally stops and just turns and looks at the camera.
I've looked at him, though. It's not, I mean, that's...
He looks like if they're... Yeah. I feel gross admitting that I looked at this.
No, don't say it. I know what you're about to say. Look at the fucking picture
There was a national news organization.
Wash your eyeballs.
You look too, because you know what I'm talking about.
I know. We all looked.
There was a really gross and exploitative shot of Pynchon walking in public with a family member, and he had a style of facial hair and a style of a coif. Mm-hmm. That I don't know why I'm hinting at what it is because you can watch the movie and see. But this character in the film was done up to have that look.
Yeah.
And I think that that's meant to be like a joking, ha ha ha, hee hee. But Brolin himself has let it slip that Pynchon was on the set.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask PTA, he's like, this guy spent his whole life, I don't want to say nothing.
Yeah.
And then if I have to guess, I think he is in the barbecue. There's a guy in the barbecue sequence at the Wolfman house that just—
Dressed up like a cop?
Well, there's a pool sequence. There's all these cops that are all like bizarrely in shape. Like they're all LA extras. LA extras.
Yeah.
And so they have that look. And then there's just this really old cop walking around that doesn't make— He's not even looking directly at the camera.
That would be funny to cast him as a cop.
Seems like the kind of thing that would make him. And that was a day that Brolin was on set because that's the day he pulls up and he beats up Joaquin.
Yeah.
And he just kept saying, if you look at the Brolin quote, he says something to the effect of, there was a lot of people on set that day.
Yeah.
And he just kind of hung out in the background and no one but me and Paul knew that that's who it was.
That's interesting.
And so my guess is it's the guy in that scene. Yeah. But if you do see him, and then you recognize someone in New York that looks like that, just leave the man alone. Leave him be, okay?
For God's sake.
He's doing his— He gave us The Simpsons. What more do you want, all right?
What were we talking about?
We were talking about Joanna Newsom.
Oh, there you go.
Is that why there's a harp in The Brothers Bloom?
Yeah. And we actually, Nathan and I talked about, my cousin Nathan, who did the music for that. At the time, we had been like, could we get Joanna Newsom to play this stuff?
Play Rachel Weisz's character?
Play the harp. Because there was a lot of harp music and we, I think, probably rightly decided not to bother poor Joanna Newsom.
Can we come borrow your art for 2 minutes?
Well, no, to have her play this stuff. Yeah. And it's like, she's got better stuff to do.
All right, last Joanna Newsom question of two.
Yeah.
She's either this phantasmic Jiminy Cricket figment of Doc's imagination, or she's a real person somewhere in the future, telling us that all of this happened.
Right.
Is she either of those things to you, or do you not care?
I think she's both, yeah.
You think she's both?
Maybe that means I don't care. I think she's both a real person in it, and she also kind of steps over and transcends into omniscient narrator. And I think that's part of the slur of Doc's addled hippie brain, I think, is...
That's a really good line. I'm going to steal that.
There you go. Yeah, I think that it makes perfect sense to me that she is a real person and she also kind of slurs over into this, you know, omniscient mode.
Those beats where she just...
Yeah, she pops in, gone. And pops out. Yeah. And I love that. I don't know, but I don't question that stuff. I don't feel like, wait, what are the rules of this? I really love just that it flows with it, you know. So
you're fine without there being established rules, even in like a genre picture that you're watching.
Yeah,
you're
cool with it. Absolutely. Rules kill everything, man. Rules are the worst.
Well, because you said you had that trouble with the plot versus the poetry in terms of that kind of that Hammett attitude.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Whereas I think that there's also those two.
I mean, I almost wish the movie made less sense. You know, I almost do, because that would lean more towards what
the other thing where the plot
the other
is
thing
so
that really pulled me into it. Yeah. Exactly.
And I think maybe actually you might have struck onto one thing that does make this difficult is there's those two types of detective movies. There's the detective movie where the plot is the thing.
Right.
And then there's the other one on the furthest end of the spectrum across from that, which is, forget it. It's just to get us in the room.
Right.
And I think sometimes actually this straddles both a little bit. We're like, no, we do need to know a little bit of this plot to get from A to B to C to Z. But the rest of it, who gives a shit? Mm-hmm. And I think maybe that's why it's a little harder for some people to grab onto it, is because it's not one or the other. I mean, I don't know how much normal people actually care about which version of a detective movie they're getting.
It's the weird thing is, though, it's like, it's almost like, I don't know what the right analogy for this is. It's almost like the skeletal remains of this labyrinth plot are completely intact in the movie. Even if to the movie there are just dead bones, you know, they are still all there. And it, like you said at the beginning, it all connects and it's all there, which is fascinating to me. It really is, like, because the movie is about like the, you know, crazy silks draped over these bones. I'm taking this analogy way the fuck out. This is horrible. But it's the movie is so not about the plot, and yet the plot is completely intact throughout the course of the film, it creates this fascinating contrast. It's really interesting. Yeah.
Dude, you should be hosting this.
Hey, step us, you know, watch your ass. You watch your ass, brother.
Jesus. This took a real turn. I was sitting here thinking, what a nice guy this is. Just coming and talking to me about this movie.
Never get comfortable, man.
You ever play with a Ouija board?
No. You know what? So
you don't mess with that stuff?
I don't fuck with that shit. I grew up religious. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my parents were like... they were like Protestants. They were like hardcore, like religious, but they're religious enough to where, I remember they gave me a D&D set because they thought it was like a cool thing, and I didn't really know what to do with it.
They gave you a D&D set?
And then took it away when the satanic panic happened.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Because when the stuff started to happen, they actually took my D&D set away. And
you still
so,
mad about that?
No.
This is a good turn to therapy.
Couch. I do feel like I do have this like inclination to get into D&D as an adult, even though I've never played it. I have friends who do games, and I'm always like, oh, maybe I'll come by.
I tried once. I tried.
Yeah?
I didn't know what I was – you know, you would get your picture taken. You don't know what to do with your hands.
Always.
That's how I felt when I was playing the game. I was like,
really? Yeah.
So I just tell you what my character is going to do?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to tell you. That's cool. I mean, I like storytelling.
What are we doing here?
Are we recording this?
Is this going to be a podcasted? What's the purpose of this? I have no purpose.
Exactly.
If it's not documented on the internet.
You know what I love? Yeah. I love that the term Ouija is owned by the Hasbro Corporation.
Is it?
That feels very Golden Fang to me. it's another random bit of a rat. It has nothing to do with anything, but we're talking about Ouija boards. Seems so Golden Fang to me that that's actually owned by the Hasbro Corporation.
Have you had experiences? We should have brought a Ouija board. That's what we should have done.
Oh, God. You know, I brought the goddamn frozen bananas. Why didn't I bring a Ouija board?
Have you had any weird experiences with them?
In the room. Yeah. No.
And thank you for being on my podcast, by the way. Appreciate you being here. Making the time.
It happened that quickly, everyone. It happened that quickly. All these suits just came into the room. My producer just started coughing in the background. She's sick now. It's like my nightmare. He shows up, infects me with the coronavirus, and he just takes my goddamn show. It happened that quickly. Jesus, it's got dark quick. You know, no.
No, you haven't?
I've never played with a Ouija board. Boy, this is taking all sorts of turns. No, and not because I thought it was weird or anything. Yeah. Maybe I'm like an asshole. But like anytime someone's like, you want to get the Ouija board? I'm like, no, it seems stupid. Like,
yeah, what, you're stupid.
We're going to move our hands together? Like, unless it's like, maybe if you were a girl I was trying to impress. And it's like, we're in high school, sure, but...
So we were at the opposite poles of not engaging with the Ouija. You were like, it's stupid shit. And I was like, I will not access the devil Satan because...
I was so done with Satan. Like, it was so passe to me. Like, and yeah. I come on. Satan Schmaten. The Dark Prince. I just seem silly to me.
Yeah, it's kind of silly.
And, you know, maybe I just don't like board games. I don't know.
Well, here's a question in terms of, like, fantasy versus reality. How do you place, like, what happens in the book? Because it is, like, the one kind of, like...
That's the weird moment.
The one weird moment in the entire thing. Yeah.
That is the moment where the weird... For all of his, you know, silliness and his love of dropping from the most lyrical chains of English language you can imagine to just dick and fart jokes, there's always a universe, or as he writes in the book, what you would call an atmosphere.
He has an engineer's brain at the end of the day, yeah.
And it's a world where, however M.C. Escher'd or Rube Goldberg it might be, it all connects. There's a logic. There's an underpinning to it. Yeah. There's a system of rules. Yeah. And this is like the one moment in the book where, cold as this scene is, as we've said in the book, where it's almost like it just gets a little weird and human and messy because there is no explanation for that. Either later on in the scene, it's just there's a beam that sends them from that board to that corner, which just so happens to be the corporate headquarters of the thing that Doc spends the whole book discovering is ruining the lives of everyone in America and Indochina with its heroin trade. So do I have, it's weird to say I wrestle with it like this is some personal trauma that I'm dealing with, but since I think about this movie so goddamn much, you know, it is something I think about a lot where was this like his weird Doper's ESP detective huntry bringing to him to a place? Is the memory even entirely accurate in that the address that's in his flashback is not really the address, but it's like his Doper's like detective hunch is like working in where he needs to go next.
I don't think there's any world where that makes sense though,
I guess this is your show. I guess, I mean, you get to say what makes sense.
Doper's ESP at the end. It makes sense that he has an instinctual hunch to look into the trunk.
But this is what happens.
There's nothing that would actually, because the notion that even if he's like making up that they called and got a message, he would have to be hallucinating that and they still end up on that exact corner.
I had to come up with something, so...
I know you did. I'm not going to let you get away. Not on my show, brother. Play by the rules.
But that's what happens when you try to fray the wire and see where everything connects. It's like you go, well, maybe it's him now projecting the address into his memory so it can leak.
It's also just really beautiful that like the entire plot, like hinge in the book even, hinges on this magical... moment.
It's
pretty cool. Yeah.
And how sad it is though, and it's so much more, it's not even sad, it's just cold and ugly in the book, but how sad it is in this scene that, you know, I mentioned this in a prior episode, Irreversible is not a film that I can rewatch a whole lot.
Yeah.
It's not fun.
Yeah.
But there's a line from that movie that I think about all the time, the title card, you know, time destroys everything. Mm-hmm. And I think about that a lot in terms of this scene. I think about that a lot in terms of this film, but especially the scene in which that is such a happy moment for Doc and Shasta. Even if she is halfway out the door, they are so happy. But he can't remember it happily because he now knows how that story ends.
Right.
And on top of that, the horror that the thing that contained so much happiness for him also contained the seeds of what was going to be this ruinous, destructive force. And I do think that's something that's so much more in the book than the film, which is that idea of realizing it's almost, you can't call like the Manson murders the death knell of the 60s. The stuff that caused the death knell of the 60s began so much earlier than you thought was there. And the antecedents were so much, or the precedents were so much further back that, you know, that building was being built before you even realized there was a company right. called The Fang.
Right.
And to see that cradled in this memory of this woman he loves is it's heartbreaking.
Yeah,
to
yeah,
me.
The contrast of that. Yeah.
And it also makes me feel very freaked out when we look at our current state of affairs, because you're like, oh, well, you know, 4 years ago, it just went to shit.
Yeah.
And then you're like, well,
foundations.
Is that when things started being bad? Or is that just when your privileged ass noticed that things laid. Might be getting a little scary out there?
I was trying to think. The thing is, Impension, like, has, and by the way, because I have some friends who I've heard they say Thomas Pynchon.
When you listen to this episode, I do one or the other every other episode because I have no
really?
Idea.
Okay.
Sometimes I'm Pynchon. Sometimes I'm Pynchon.
Pynchon.
My Missouri slur
comes in. I get that Colorado.
Yeah, you know, Pynchon, Pynchon. All I do know is he's not going to actually come out
he's
and correct
me. He's not going to correct us.
So who cares?
Great if he did, by the way. So I'll just keep saying it wrong in hopes of provoking him.
Let's provoke one of the 21st century's great artists by mildly mispronouncing his name. And maybe he'll come on your new podcast.
Maybe, we'll see. So what was I saying? So I was trying to think if, because I don't do this and I don't try and get anyone to read Gravity's Rainbow anymore. I used to like try and like close friends once in a while. I would like say, I'm going to try
like kind
and
of a
like,
dick, though, when you push it.
Always,
don't you?
Always. But that's why it would always just selected people. But if I would, I would say, this book is going to make you literally feel in somewhere in the course of it, every emotion a human is capable of feeling.
Yep.
And the thing is though, like the one element, because it's at the heart of this scene in the movie, that kind of romantic, that deeply just giving yourself over to pure unadulterated romance of this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they're curled up in the, when they're kissing in the doorway and her leg curls up and just like that kind of, and that is the one note that I don't know that I have ever, you know, I feel like with Pynchon, there are things that are emotional. Mm-hmm. There are absolutely emotional connections between people. There are moments of kind of romance, although they're usually like doomed moments of romance. You know, there's always some darker subtext underneath it. That's one thing that I feel like is kind of baked into the heart of what PTA does that I don't know if that note exists in Pynchon's music. You know, it's an interesting thing.
I don't think it does. Yeah. And even in something as, oh God, here we go with something as symphonic. Yeah. As Gravity's Rainbow.
Oh, Christ.
Yep. I'm pulling the show back. I'm bringing it back. Yeah. it's this kind of the one note that's, as you said, that level of unabashed sweetness, that willingness to be so open and just lovey-dovey.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
God damn it. He loves this girl. He's going to love her. He's just going to smooch the seat. Like he's almost like a puppy dog. He just smooches the side of her face until she like pushes him off.
Not out
of annoyance, but just like it's that level of sweetness. Yeah, I think it's something that is totally unique to PTA's version of the story. That said, as we slowly wind this thing down, I have a question about, again, your interpretation. We've already talked about, you know, how you do you view Sore Liege as a real person or as Jiminy Cricket. I was, as one does, rewatching another film recently, Brick, and I was noticing a lot of similarities. You know, it's kind of interesting how both stories are about a detective character who's pursuing a woman who maybe doesn't want to be saved, at least not by him,
right.
Who's getting kind of enmeshed in some heroin deals gone wrong.
That's true. And he has like a false notion in his head.
He might owe you a cut, man.
I think he does, man.
He might have to come out of hiding.
He's going to have to call in if he wants to. The lines are open.
Otherwise, Ryan's going to get on Twitter and announce that PTA or that Pynchon and PTA ripped him off. Brick did it first.
Just go on a rant. Yeah.
That script was around for a while, even before the movie. People, he might have passed it. He could have seen it. But yeah, both are similar in that way, in that, you know, woman lost in the heroin trade and or part of a cog in the heroin trade.
To be fair, that's an enduring trope in detective fiction going way back.
What are you talking about? Seriously? That wasn't my point. My point was, though, I was, and maybe because I've been thinking about it so much for this film, rewatching it this last time through, how kind of morally complicated and even culpable in some ways Brendan is.
Oh, yeah. That was the whole point. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It wasn't that I didn't see it when I first saw it. It's just, especially with a film that's kind of complicated like that, you almost have to pick the thread that you follow anytime you rewatch it. And this one, that was the note that really hummed in my head. It's like, wow, Brendan, he's got a lot of backbone, but I don't know if I'd want to be his pal.
Yeah, he's terrible.
And especially with the way he treats Emily. Is it Emily? Did I forget
Emily? Yeah.
Because then that's, now you're really going to take my show from me to get the name. But just his perception of her as someone needing to be rescued. And her, and there's that great scene, that flashback, she's desperately trying to say, you got
to
let me go.
Like,
you're not the guy.
Yeah.
I love you. I almost wish you were the guy. But you're not the guy sitting back here hating everybody.
Yeah.
And the more that I've been talking about this film and the more that Shasta has been coming up recently, because she disappears for the whole movie until this middle sequence, is talking to people and really thinking about how she is treated by Doc in the film. And that I love Doc. I love him. I think he's a hero. But I do think there's an element to that where the version of Shasta that his mind presents to us, I don't think is maybe the most accurate Shasta Faye Hepworth in the world. Sure. I think the accurate Shasta Faye Hepworth, the real Shasta Faye Hepworth, is the one that we see in the love scene later on and a little bit of in the opening sequence. This idea that he views her as this person who needs to be extricated from the Fang, yet we never see her entirely unhappy with all of the choices that she's made the way he's made. And I was just curious if you picked up on that, or do you view this as purely a love thing, a love film where he's supposed to rescue her from darkness, or if she's more of an avatar of that darkness wrestling with?
Yeah, no, I think the movie, and we've been kind of talking about elements of this throughout the whole thing. I mean, I think one of the things the movie does is, with his relationship with her, but even, and this even applies to, you know, the thing we were saying with the Joanna Newsom character, like it really does in this beautiful poetic way get to the sadness of, even with a relationship that kind of defines you in your head, the notion of how much can you, it sounds even trite to say it, but how much can you know another person? How much can you even know? You know, and that's what he's trying, kind of seeing her through this fog of memory. And he gets these snippets of real interactions with her and he's trying to interpret what the fuck those mean. And even at the end of the book, when they're joining, you know, the book end, or at the end of the movie when the book ends with him alone,
but he's alone in the car
at the end of the book. And the movie, when they're driving through, literally through the fog, they're lost in the fog, and the notion of, you know, and then that wonderful thing of like the beam of light breaking through, is it hope, is it paranoia of someone following them, is it the notion of does he believe it, does he not, and that little smile that he gives,
PTA that little smile,
what does that mean, I don't know, and then we're out. It's less kind of that he's, I didn't read into it kind of the dynamic that he's projecting himself as like a white knight coming to, which is more of the Brendan thing. It's more the sickness of sort of setting your moral compass on idea and refusing to bend when new information comes in, just pushing straight forward. This, I didn't quite get that, but what I did get is just the sadness that I think he's very aware of he's picking through the fog and trying to figure out, you know, this is, what was this relationship? There's someone I deeply cared about and loved. And it's when something you had is gone, and it's trying to put the pieces together a bit, you know. And I think his drug-addled brain is kind of a great analog for kind of when you've been shattered by something, by a loss, and you're trying to kind of pick through what was reality and what wasn't, you know.
Because even your process itself is shattered at that
Absolutely, point. Yeah, exactly.
Jesus.
It's beautiful.
We got heavy here, didn't we?
Hey, we did it, man.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on your show today,
Ryan. I'm so happy you could make the time to be here. Thank you.
You know, it was a busy day, but I took a break from the pandemic to come talk to you today.
So
I figure
kind.
I owed you.
You're so kind.
Oh, God. We're gonna be like in a locked off zone here.
Thank God.
Well, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for coughing, because we've got the guys in the suits out front. So.
Perfect.
I'll have fun living in the concentration center with you at Kaiser Permanente, which, by the way, I thought was very appropriate. The address that they get sent to.
I looked it up. Where does it lead to now? It's a hospital on
nowadays,
Sunset, right? Yeah.
Nowadays, see, this is why you should have been the host, because I ruined our perfect ending by jumping back to this. But no, it's the Kaiser Permanente Center on
Sunset.
Sunset,
right?
Just east of Vermont.
That's right. By where I live.
Is literally
where
it's positioned in the book. Where Pynchon writes, it's on Sunset, just east of Vermont.
Remember, he gives
it's something about it when you look at it. It's that big looming glass square, not quite a fang, but kind of still tooth shaped.
Yeah.
It's just this big ugly glass corporate building.
Yeah,
that's right where Doc and Shasta had their happiest moment, though she was 1 foot out the door.
There you go, man.
Well, again, Ryan, thank you for having me on your show today.
Oh, you're so welcome.
I'm going to go back and finish Knives Out 2.
Come back anytime. Let me know when the script is done.
there's this great podcaster character in the show. Really charming, handsome.
This is all about Inherent Vice. What is
it's more like we're going to have all the same actors play different characters. Daniel Craig is going to be really handsome and in shape playing this podcaster who watches way too many movies and then talks about him. I think it's going to be it's really going to throw people for a loop. It's really going to surprise them.
Let's do it.
Really going to surprise them. All right, Ryan. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's fun.
For the most nerdy endeavor, perhaps, of your entire life, even more
which
so than
really
the few weeks of Dungeons & Dragons that you had, this out-nerds that so much.
It's an accomplishment. Thanks, man.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you for talking about Inherent Vice and for complimenting my PTA impression. Thank you for stealing my show and my intellectual property.
You're so welcome.
And, just thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening. And please come back next time where myself and a very, very, very special guest are going to stand in the shadow of the Golden Fang.
Wowie zowie. Hearing a talk from early March sure feels like a bittersweet memory these days. Quarantine blues and all. But I guess a memory latticed with the bitter and the sweet is about as appropriate as one can get when it comes to a movie like Inherent Vice. And lucky for us, we have a host like Ryan John... Travis. Right, Travis. To guide us through it. But what comes next? Will we ever untangle the mystery of the Golden Fang? Will I actually be narrating Rian Johnson's subconscious from here on out? While Travis writes Knives Out 2, Knives Sharper... We'll see what we can see next time on Increment Vice.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.